Hi, I'm Tara. We have been discussing international business. And continuing with that, let's talk about some more of the influencing factors. We have been discussing these in various, ways throughout, but let's look at some more cases and aspects which we may not obviously think would impact cross-border business, but do, and let's see some of the recent trends. So we want to know what are the motivations for companies, what are the environments which are enabling, environments which are restrictive, what are the various elements, whether it's economic, whether it is political, cultural, legal, structural, demographic, all of these elements which impact international business. So, one of the things to keep in mind is that we see trends which can be impacted by volatile situations like the COVID situation which happened, during which we suddenly saw that there was a very high demand for goods versus services. So, in fact, for our PCs and for our various Lenovos and HPs and Dells, etc., we suddenly saw a very high demand. And we have to be prepared in future as much as possible to be able to respond to volatile situations, whether it's COVID, whether it's war, because that influences not just the supply side of things, but also influences the demand side. Now, we would not have anticipated that in COVID, when COVID happened, suddenly demand for services fell and it was your merchandise goods demands which went up higher. Post that, of course, services, demand for services and global export, global trade of services has regained its growth and gone back to pre-pandemic levels. But influencing factors have to be kept in mind, where some are recurring influencing factors, and then there are certain emergencies and unexpected developments which happen globally, which have to then be responded to appropriately and also become a, they become part of the decision making. For example, COVID ended and war started, Russia, Ukraine, Middle East. All of these things have impacted supply side and demand side the world over and heavily influenced international business operations of companies and of governments. For example, the companies exiting Russia en masse because of they don't want to boycott Russia boycott, or for that matter, Russia becoming one of the top four trading partners for India because our imports from Russia for petroleum, crude, etc., skyrocketed because other countries were not buying, but we decided to capitalize on that. So you have influencing factors which could be, recurring, expected, and then you could have influencing factors which have unexpectedly out of everyone's control appeared and how best companies and countries respond to those. So we'll look at some of these factors and see, how the international business operations have been impacted by them. Now, some of the very obvious factors where, which are not like these emergency factors that I was talking about are size of a country, when it comes to India, everyone wants to do business with India. Everyone wants to sign an FTA with, India. So, size of a country, the population, demographic, a large consuming, ambitious population definitely impacts. Costs, cost differences. How can I price my products? What are the duty structures, etc., which will impact my price? For example, let me give you a very simple example of the brand H&M. Now, in India, if you buy H&M products, from what I've heard from people and from what I've read, H&M products in India are not very low end pricing wise. Whereas if you buy H&M products in the US or, you know, in some other Western countries, then they are a lot more cost effective. Now, obviously, some of the duties, etc., on apparels would be coming into play here. So differences in costs become an element. Currency values. Now, the Indian rupee vis-a-vis the US dollar is roughly about 83.5 rupees per US dollar. Currency values play an important role. Appreciation, depreciation. When Indian rupee depreciates versus a US dollar, which is the world's largest reserve currency, then our export value increases. How? If I am an exporter and I'm getting $10 for my product sold outside the country, for those $10 at the rate of 83.5 rupees, I would be getting 835 rupees. If my rupee depreciates to 84 rupees, then for that same $10, because I'm contracting my business in dollars, for that same $10, without doing anything, just because of depreciation of rupee, instead of 835 rupees, now I'm getting 840 rupees. So movements in currencies impact decision making, size of markets, technological factors. What is the image of a country? Is it easy to do technology in? Are there a lot of challenges? Because today you cannot do business without technological, adoption of technology. So without adoption of technology or with challenges of technological adoption, things become difficult. For example, when we were talking about in a different module, when we were talking about international, your ships and your shipping industry and your seafaring business, then there are technological factors in the maritime industry which have not been very easy for all countries to adopt. Now, obviously, those will impact, your maritime trade decisions. There are political factors, which come into, which impact in India the ease of doing business, like Make in India or Atmanirbhar Bharat or FTAs that we sign would obviously help international investors. Legal factors come into play. I was giving the example of Financial Times, which despite being a very solid brand, ended up getting stuck in a lot of legal issues in India, despite the fact that India was a very large English-speaking market, so would have a very large consumer base for its publications. Cultural factors impact, for example, in India, beef is a complete ban. When I was talking about IKEA, then certain products which internationally, which use cow hide, absolutely cannot be offered in India online or offline. So a lot of these things are, influencing factors. In certain parts of the Islamic world, you have Sharia banking, you have Islamic banking. Those beliefs have to be and practices have to be adhered to if you want to do business with those countries. Now, when it comes to demarcation in terms of income, gross national income per capita, then there is a classification of low-income countries, middle-income countries, and upper-middle-income countries, and higher-income economies. Now, some of the low-income countries, as expected, are Afghanistan, Ethiopia, Niger. Interestingly, when I was giving an example earlier in terms of the water pollution in River Niger, you see that it is these low-income economies which have been exploited the worst, where MNCs may have benefited from, their facilities here, but at the same time, they have left the negative impact of pollution. Then you have your lower middle-income countries like Angolia, Kenya, India. See, we have very, very wealthy people in India, but One of the cons is that we have a very huge income distribution imbalance. So we have a very large disparity in income, which is why when you see the per capita income, then as far as per capita income is concerned, we are in the lower middle economies rather than, maybe in the higher middle income, despite the fact that we know we, have some of the wealthiest people in Asia and the world living in the country. Then your upper middle income economies are some of your, Argentina, Brazil, Indonesia. And then, of course, you have your developed world where your high income economies come in. Australia, Belgium, UK, US, UAE, etc. Now, some of the other factors are for a country, as far as international trade is concerned, are what is its GDP, the inflation, are there savings, what's the balance of payments? Because, balance of payments, fiscal deficit in terms of your export versus imports will impact decisions on do we need to clamp down on imports, do we need to impose duties on exports, etc. These factors will come into the decision-making process. Now, the decisions which are to be taken are what do we produce, how much do we produce, not just produce, how do we distribute it. When we were talking about some of the bottling plants, then for the bottling plants, the distribution network had been advantageous in India. Otherwise, despite producing the right quantity, if the distribution wasn't working well, that would be a problem. Once again, to reiterate why distribution becomes important, when we were talking about, when I was talking about the duties on the tariffs on onions being reduced. Now, because of the reduced duty not having been factored in the customs systems, it appears that there are reports that there are cases of that lying unattended at ports not going out. So clearly, and this is a perishable commodity, so it is going to end up getting destroyed. So clearly, a glitch in the distribution network, something which has caused a blockade, is going to impact both the supply side and obviously it is going to impact the people to whom it was being exported. Very important to talk about the kind of economic system of the country. Is it a market economy? Is it a mixed economy, which is not entirely a capitalist economy, but a combination of capitalist economy and some role of the government to play, like India? Typical example of market economy, capitalist economy is USA, Japan. And then when it comes to centrally planned or controlled economy, which is China, Cuba, North Korea being the absolute other extreme. A market economy or a very typical quintessential capitalist economy is the USA or the Japan. Private firms or individuals own the means of production. There's very little involvement from government on the business side of things. Demand and supply is what is the main driving factor. And consumers are the key factor on the demand side, and firms produce what consumers are ready and willing to pay for. Now, here the government is primarily passing laws to protect businesses, consumers, to Fort Knox, which is their treasury in the US, for issuance of money, for administrative things like policing, etc., and for maintaining state properties. Rest on the business side, there is very little to no interference. Now, the advantages are that it's strictly demand and supply driven. There are no restrictions from the authorities. There is ease of doing business. It is completely a free marketplace for the dynamics of production and consumption to play out. And entry barriers are not there. So competition is not an it can be competitive, it can be efficient, there can be a lot of innovation. Now, the disadvantages, of course, here are that one of the biggest disadvantages is that equality of income is not there. The income disparity, distribution of wealth is very, very skewed. Also, if you look at efficiency, if you look at, some of the services, because of low entry barriers, there are market imperfections, there are inefficiencies. Also, there is misallocation of resources. Now, one of the other factors which has very detrimental impact on the local communities and the country are elements like gun violence, drugs. So, in the US, the ease of buying a weapon has led to so many disastrous, mass shootings that we are aware of, other than individual violence. Now, a lot of people who are supporters of the gun lobby, talk about or stand by this liberty and, their amendments in their right to carry a gun amendments and laws and in their constitution. But for that freedom, look at the negative which is coming up. That is so, it is such a dangerous thing. So that has taken the free market economy to the other extreme, where this freedom has gone too far in the interest of, protecting rights, etc. So one has to think of how to balance it out. But now, when you think about their gun lobby, when you think about the companies manufacturing these weapons, these companies are so powerful from a financial point of view, from a point of view of having a say and an influence on the governments, that it has become very, very difficult to have absolutely any impact to do anything about such laws. So while the freedom is creating all the goodness of, having everything under the sun, all sorts of products available to you, products and services available to you, your most basic human right of safety and protection may be compromised because of the negative extreme of this, capitalist economy. Now, when we come to centrally planned or controlled economies, China, of course, our neighbor is a good example of a right wing, government, but which did its, which had a very positive economic growth for their country. When we talk about Cuba, unfortunately, has not done so well. One, it has been massively jeopardized by the embargoes by successive governments in the US. Trump had a massive policy for Cuba of maximum pressure policy. And the Biden administration continued with this maximum pressure policy. Within Cuba, there has been mismanagement. There has been corruption. There is absolutely no connection between what people earn and what is the price of basic items like food items, fuel, etc. Fuel has become completely unaffordable. There are, on 1st of March, there was a massive, imposition of a 5-time multiple premium on fuel prices by the government in Cuba. So as a result of this, their economy and the industry is completely in shambles. Sugar, which was one of their biggest exports, sustaining the economy, bringing in revenue, employment, all of that has been disastrous. In fact, Cuba, which one would have not imagined, became an importer of sugar. There was a time when it was the pride of the Caribbean as far as sugar exports were concerned. But there is very little investment from the government on sugar now. The government seems to be focusing more on investments on tourism, which actually, have also hurt the sugar industry. Over and above that, there is no fuel. Fuel is unaffordable. So trucks don't turn up. Transport doesn't turn up. If transport and materials don't turn up, there are days and days when people, laborers who are ready and willing to work, can't work because there is no means of transport, there is no fuel. So there are days and days where productive work is just not being done, it's halted. So if you see the state of Cuba and you see the illegal migration into other countries of Cubans, you know, when they escape the, you know, when they leave the country and enter other countries, mass migration out of Cuba, then since the 1959 revolution, the last 2 years have seen record numbers of people exiting Cuba. So the Cuban economy, from an inflation point of view, from a management corruption point of view, from a the state investment attention point of view, has failed in all these avenues. So clearly it is a centrally planned and controlled economy that has not worked out well. Now China may have its share of troubles and impositions. We saw in the recent past when there were all these rumors of the Jack Ma, the founder of Alibaba, disappearing, and then all sorts of rumors and stories about what was done to him by the government in China, the restrictions on him, the persecution of him. We don't know the reality, but something was going on because he disappeared and he's come back a new man. And so while there is that state authoritative hold in China, economic growth has happened, so in Cuba the state is also imposing very authoritative, and economy has also has not worked out. So it's the worst of both. In China you have the cons, but you also have the pros. But in Cuba you've only had the cons of this centrally planned economy. Here the government becomes absolutely paramount. They are the ones who are deciding what to produce, what to charge, pricing mechanism, employment, etc. Everywhere the government has a say, and clearly if they don't get it right in certain countries, then we see what happens. Yes, there is more equal distribution of wealth in a centrally planned economy like Cuba, but there is hardly any wealth to distribute. So production is for need rather than profit, but not even enough is being produced to share among the to take care of all the basic needs. Think about USSR. Before USSR broke up, when USSR broke up in 1990-91, before that, think of the USSR bloc. There was hardly enough food for everyone. There was nothing, like the first McDonald's came into Russia in 1990, and it was like it had queues of a few kilometers long or something, So while there was equal distribution of wealth, while no one was way higher or way poorer than the others, but there was hardly enough going around, just about basic, food and necessities. So equitable distribution is coming, but at the same time, it's coming at the cost of general growth and, comforts and luxuries being available. Bureaucracy, red tape, corruption. Now, in all these countries that we're talking about, it's not like money has not been made by, unscrupulous elements. So that has happened, and all of that has happened with general standard of living being very low, and basic needs not being met. Now, when we talk about the Western European countries, these are classic examples of mixed economies. There is a balance between, the state involvement and the market economy. And countries like Sweden, UK, etc. follow this economy. Of course, when it comes to UK, keep in mind that in 2016, UK had a decisive vote to exit the European Union, and that is what we know as Brexit. And of course, a lot of the influencing factors that we have been talking about in the case of UK, among a lot of the influencing factors, is also factor of migration of people from other countries, which was an influencing factor as well. But barring this, Brexit episode, most of the European countries, Western European countries, would be your mixed economy. Now, here the role of the government when it comes to the Indian context, which is also a mixed economy, is a lot of regulation and legalities. We have our SB, SEBI, IRDA, Reserve Bank of India, TRAI, now RBI is the central bank, not the, regulatory body, but the central bank, like the Fed. And the government's role in a mixed economy like India becomes education, defense, healthcare. They do lay down policies to make competition fair in the private sector, to, restrict monopolies, etc., and to restrict, for example, in India, you can't go out and just buy a gun, the way you can in the US. And there are lots more stringent norms. So there is a balance between government and private sector. The public, transport, the infrastructure, etc., is mostly provided by the government, and it is the private sector which is taking care of the mass consumers' demands. Now, some of the macroeconomic goals are employment, price stability, laying down policy so that economic growth can happen for the private players, and of course to keep a balance between exports and imports. For example, when we were talking about tariffs, duties, etc., these are not levied by private sectors. These are levied by the government over and above the pricing that the private sector is coming up with. Very important in today's international global environment has become technological factors. So the image of a country as a technology provider is very important, because if a country is perceived as a country where you will not be able to adapt your technology or implement your technological needs, then obviously business is going to be very difficult to conduct on a very, very micro level as well. So the top five countries which are perceived as with a very good technological image are Sweden, Finland, Switzerland, Norway, New Zealand. Now, when it comes to technology, technology has five stages. You become aware of something new. You become intrigued and curious by it. So you decide to acquire it, to adopt it. Then after the acquisition, you have to adapt it, you understand it, you implement it and start using it. And then during that phase, you have upgrades which come in. We have constant upgrades in software, and we get update notifications, etc. So improvements are made, adaptations are done, changes are made. And then you reach a point where technology becomes obsolete, and something new starts coming in. Haven't we seen that? I mean, when we think about the old Nokia phones, there was a time when that was the only phone that one had. Today, no one is even touching a Nokia phone as a prop. So you see that it went through all of those cycles till this whole Android and everything else came in, and that became completely obsolete and obsolete and declined. So one has to stay constantly dynamic when it comes to the technology cycle. So gives you an idea of how the various stages evolve for technology, for service providers, through awareness to decline. Now in India, we have the advantage of a skilled workforce, so our various stages of adaption have been a lot more seamless than probably a lot of our competitors. Even the advancement in terms of upgradations, other options, we have been better poised to address those. And of course, in the decline stage is, when we look at those old computers of ours, which literally look like, today we look at them, they look like something out of the Transformers movie or something. We would have never imagined that those would decline to an extent that, today we are using these tablets, etc. So that is where companies have to adapt to responding with the newer technology. Now, for services industry, and since services has become so important, they also have to be aware that random blips in what happens in the global economy, like COVID, can heavily impact suddenly the service industry. Suddenly, when we saw the COVID impact, suddenly services demand went down and goods and services demand went up. Suddenly, the demand for your laptops, etc., suddenly went up. The product was required. So, to be able to respond to these dynamic changing conditions, investments have to be made. Investments by way of R&D, investments by way of patent applications, innovations, trademarks applied for, charges for use of intellectual property rights, etc. Recently, there was a report where Walmart, a few years ago, Walmart upgraded its technology, technological status by investing almost, across the board technology was upgraded at Walmart, and they invested almost 2% of their revenue in the technological upgradation. So not just for companies, but for countries as a whole, there has to be expenditure for research and development, which should be as a percentage of GDP, so that, it is significant and meaningful, and the world can see that you are a country where they will not have an issue adapting technology. As I was saying, with the sudden change with COVID, and suddenly, people had never imagined they are going to be homebound. The whole dynamic of what was required, what was in demand, completely changed, And post that, of course, we have seen that e-commerce has grown in a way that one would have never imagined that it would grow at. Travel has become one of the largest growing industries post-pandemic. Look at the way the prices of everything as when it comes to travel, whether it's hotel, whether it's airfares, etc. Everything has skyrocketed. One would have never imagined that things would swing back and change the way they have.